I'm Sheila Guest, and this is Midday. Professor Makita Brotman is a psychoanalyst, cultural critic, and Oxford-educated scholar of the humanities. She'd had the experience of teaching smart, well-prepared students at MICA, but what would it be like to share books she loved with men convicted of serious crimes and serving time for them at Jessup Correctional Institute? She tells what it's like in her new book, The Maximum Security Book Club, Reading Literature in a Men's Prison. In this hour, we'll talk to Brotman about what the experience meant. We'll ask what surprised her about the men and the workings of the prison and how their discussions changed her view of literature. And we'll meet one of her readers, now free. The Maximum Security Book Club on Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. Before we start an interesting discussion we're going to take up today, I want to take a moment to acknowledge the tragedy in Orlando, Florida. As you've been hearing, very early yesterday, a gunman opened fire at a gay nightclub, an attack that left 49 people dead and 53 wounded. The gunman was shot and killed by police. This is the largest mass shooting in U.S. history. Tomorrow, Midday, we'll be looking at a factor covered by the media in this and previous mass shootings, mental illness. That's tomorrow, and I hope you'll be back with us for that. But today, we're going to approach literature from a direction few of us have thought of, from inside a men's prison. Makita Brotman is a professor of humanities at the Maryland Institute College of Art. She was educated at Oxford. She's a psychoanalyst as well as cultural critic. A few years ago, she had the idea of sharing some of the books she loves with people who would bring some entirely different experiences to them. And she asked to start a book club at Jessup Correctional Institute. She has captured the result in her latest book, her eighth book. This is The Maximum Security Book Club, Reading Literature in a Men's Prison. Professor Makita Brotman, welcome to Midday.
Thanks for having me.
Of all the challenges that prisoners face, why did you think discussing literature with them would be valuable?
I didn't necessarily think it would be valuable. I wasn't really thinking that far ahead. I was on my first sabbatical, and I wanted to continue teaching. So in some respects, it wasn't really an altruistic exercise. I have to confess that I was thinking mainly of myself. I wanted to continue teaching. I love teaching, and I didn't really want to be without anything to do with my time during the sabbatical. And I've always been interested in prisons. I know people who've taught in prisons. They seem to have found it a very valuable and satisfying experience. And so I emailed various librarians in the prisons around Baltimore to see if any of them were interested in any of them might have men who were interested or prisoners who were interested in responding to a book club. They weren't, but the librarian at Jessup Correctional Institute got back to me and said that they did have some college level classes there, although they weren't for credit, and I might begin by teaching a couple of those classes. And then find from among the men in my classes to see if there were any who might be interested in setting up a book club. So I began by teaching a couple of college level classes, one in writing and one in psychology, at Jessup Correctional Institute, which is a men's prison. And after that, from among the men who were in my college level classes. I gathered together a group who said they were interested in reading literature.
Let me interrupt and get a sense. Was this something that you had picked up in the classes you taught that you thought the men either had they suggested it, or what you learned in your first experience teaching with the men that led you to think the next step should be
Well,
a book club, a discussion?
The book club is what I wanted to do all along. I'm a literature professor, and reading literature and talking about it is what I do best and what I wanted to spend my time doing. And so one of the prisoners who had been there for a long time, who was in charge of organizing the college programs, named Vincent, I asked him to select from among the men who could be trusted, who were smart, who would obey the rules, would be respectful, and to pick a group of men who he thought would find this this endeavor valuable.
Well, back up for me. Even before that, though, I mean, so was it difficult to get agreement from prison officials to do a book club as opposed to a more structured kind of class?
It was set up as one of the classes. Its official name was Advanced Literature, so it was really a part of the general prison educational program.
Okay.
Except I brought in the books. It was the same man who came back every semester, and so it was one of the regular educational courses. So it was a kind of book club in disguise.
A book club in disguise. That makes it that's
secret
almost,
book club.
That's almost as intriguing as calling it the Maximum Security Book Club. How did you pick the books?
Again, I wasn't really thinking ahead. I wanted to talk about the books that I loved the most and that I had enjoyed the most when I was at college, and the books that were most influential on me. And these were difficult books, and they were dark books. I have a kind of dark taste in literature. And I didn't know if they would be suitable for the men, but I wanted to give it a shot. So when it turned out that the men began to struggle with them, I would sometimes adapt and change gears and choose something that was a little more accessible.
But I do want to ask you about that, because mm-hmm. in the first book, I think the first book you all took up, certainly the first one in your book, Maximum Security Book Club, it is Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad. Mm-hmm. And you tell us how you yourself struggled with it when you read it when you were quite young, and you weren't ready for it, you mm-hmm. said. And you tell us that every time you read it, you discover new things. And yet you seemed a bit surprised that it was an uphill struggle for the men. And I was like, what, wasn't she paying attention to her own experience with that book?
I was surprised in the sense that I had an amazing teacher who was able to enlighten me and to make me see that this was a kind of book that I had to read differently, and I hadn't really been paying enough attention to it. And I believed, and I suppose I wanted to believe, that I could be that kind of teacher for these men, and I could enlighten them, and I could help them see that there was far more to this book than simply lots of long words and difficult sentences that didn't go anywhere. However, unfortunately, I turned out not to be that kind of teacher, because I wasn't really able to help them to see it the way that I eventually came to see it. We just struggled and struggled and struggled. And yet I still felt that within that struggle, there were so many oblique directions and different paths we went down and different experiences that the men told me about and that they related to, that I started to find that even the sidetracks were incredibly fascinating and rich and worth going down.
You write about how you had to learn to embrace digressions.
That's right.
Tell us more about that.
Well, at first it was difficult for me because I was still clinging to the college teaching mindset where there's a syllabus and learning directives and one can't really go too far off the track. And at first I would get rather anxious when the men would go on digressions and say, you know, tell me about things that this reminded them of or relate this to experiences that they had in other prisons. But very quickly I started to realize that it didn't really matter. We were all learning something. And for example, there's a moment in Heart of Darkness where the narrator Marlowe is his helmsman on the ship is shot, and Marlowe looks down and realizes that his shoes are filled with blood, and one of the men started telling me about a death of a friend of his in San Quentin where he'd had the same experience. He watched this man bleed out right in front of him through the bars of his cell, and it was a really shocking and disturbing story. And that's what the scene reminded him of. But instead of interrupting, I realized that this was a really fascinating digression and we were all learning something. I was certainly learning something about these men's experiences, and their lives in various prisons that they'd been in were something rather akin to Marlowe's journey down the Congo River itself. And there was a similar kind of savagery.
That is Professor Makeda Brotman here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about her latest book, Maximum Security Book Club, Reading Literature in a Men's Prison. You can be part of this conversation. Have you ever spent time in prison that you'd like to talk about? Or what do you think of the idea of prisoners having access to this kind of discussion, having access to college-level work in general? You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org, or you can phone us at 410-662-8780. Tell us about the experience of just going into the prison. What is that like? I gather, for example, that you couldn't wear the kind of attractive dress that you're wearing today. It's sleeveless, and that was one of the rules. Tell us about the clothing restrictions and what you had to do to show up.
Well, it's perfectly reasonable that as a woman in a men's prison, I had to dress conservatively. So there were I had to cover my arms. There's no skirts above the knee. I had to pass through a metal detector, and that's quite strict. So I couldn't wear, for example, an underwire bra because the metal detector would pick it up. So I always had to remember setting out for prison that I had to wear a sports bra that didn't have underwire. I couldn't wear any jewelry. I couldn't wear a metal belt. I couldn't wear any metal in my shoes. You're only given 3 chances to get through the metal detector. And if you don't get through, then you can't go into the prison for the day.
For the whole day.
Right. You had to leave.
At least a couple of times. So tell us how often you left the...
Right.
The...
I had to... Well, one time I had a T-shirt it was an incredibly hot day. It was a day in July like this. And I had a T-shirt which had capped sleeves, which I thought would count as sleeves. But I was sent away because capped sleeves count as sleeveless. But fortunately, there's a thrift store not too far away. And I got used to making the dash in my car to the thrift store to grab something that was a cover up and make it back to the prison. And that often took up half of the class time. But the same with a dress that I believed was perfectly respectable. But I was even wearing an underskirt, but I was told that it was see-through. And sometimes I felt that the guards were more hostile to this endeavor than the men themselves were. And perhaps that was the case because this was an extra work for them. I mean, the volunteers are helping the prisoners, after all. And this is something that, you know, the guards are not being paid to do, to help volunteers give college-level classes to the prisoners. The guards themselves aren't being offered these college-level classes. Perhaps that was natural for them to be hostile.
And part of what they had to do was escort you from when you went through security. You could not then travel, walk to where the class was going to be.
No, I couldn't. And I had to have an escort. And sometimes I would have to wait for rather a long time for the escort. And sometimes it crossed my mind that I was being held up deliberately. But I'm not sure if that was the case. I mean, it's a very difficult job being a prison guard. They face a lot of violence and hostility in their own right. So... But that was certainly the most difficult part of my job. There was certainly no hostility from the men, but there was a lot of aggression from the guards and the correctional officers themselves. And if there was tension in the prison, it was between the prisoners and the correctional officers. Certainly, I certainly never faced any kind of hostility from the prisoners myself.
We're going to talk lots more. We're going to take a quick break here. I just would like to get sort of an overview thought from you before we take that break, Makita Brotman, about how do you think the book club worked out?
Well, I'm still doing it. I'm still running it. So
I know that. I'm not trying to put a stake in it. Right. I'm not trying to say it's over, but I'm trying to get a sense before we continue the rest of the show.
It did not work out like I thought it would. But it worked out in other ways. Let me put it like that.
And that's exactly what I'm hoping we're going to learn a lot more about in the rest of this show. Makita Brotman, the author of Maximum Security Book Club, Reading Literature in a Men's Prison, is with us us this hour. And you can be too. You can send us an email at midday at WYPR.org, or you can phone us 410-662-8780. What do you think about this whole enterprise? Does it intrigue you? Does it make a lot of sense? Give us a call. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. When MICA Humanities professor Makita Brotman had the idea of starting a book club behind bars, she needed to persuade authorities it was a good idea. She also needed an accomplice inside who knew the prison, knew its rules, knew its prisoners, and that person was Vincent, who now has been out of prison for 2 years. Welcome to the show, Vincent.
Thank you for having me.
We're glad to have you. You entered prison at age 21, sentenced to 2 life terms for felony murder. Help us understand what you were doing in prison when Makita Brotman proposed a book club.
Well, what we had developed there at the prison was a volunteer college program, since the grants had run out and weren't allowed for Pell grants.
Were actually abolished 22 years ago. I didn't realize it was that long ago.
Yes,
1994.
That's right. And so, but prior to that, I had gotten my own college education through the Pell Grant, and then I went on and got a master's degree with that. But when you see the benefit of education, I mean, everyone knows that college education and family are two of the top two things that can help a person be successful upon their release. And I just felt that it was necessary to give that opportunity to people who hadn't had that opportunity. And so we created a volunteer college program with professors from Loyola, Georgetown University, University of Baltimore, and MICA, and two others. Yeah,
Morgan State.
Yeah. And so they, she came in through, MICA and did these courses, the psychology course, and then, out of that developed what we call the book club, but it was a little bit more deeper than a book club, I believe.
So you ended up starting with 9 men, Makita? Mm-hmm. There were 9 readers. And Vincent, I got the impression it sort of fell to you to decide who was going to get into this book club and who wasn't. Did you have a lot more people asking, or at the beginning was there not that much interest?
There was always people asking to get into it, but she wanted to keep it at a more manageable rate. We always had 25 to 35 students in most of the classes.
So how did you make that choice?
Who were dedicated to their other classes. So, of course, it really wasn't that hard to see. And plus, when you live with people, you get to see their value system. So you just make a choice.
Can you tell us, Makita Brotman, what kind of expectations you had of who your readers would be, of what these guys would be like, and what turned out different?
Well, I told Vincent that I wanted men who would be respectful, who had shown in other classes that they were capable of doing the reading. I asked them to respond with a page of work, so I wouldn't let them into the room unless they'd written a page in response to the reading. That they were capable of reading advanced literature, even if they struggled and didn't necessarily understand it, and that they would not interrupt one another, that they'd listen to one another talk, and that they'd be respectful, and that there was no reading ahead. And I think everyone kept to those rules, except sometimes people couldn't do the reading for various reasons, like they were on lockdown, or the prison was on lockdown, or when the week the Ravens won the Super Bowl, nobody did the reading for that week. And they showed me why that was so important and why it was necessary that nobody did the reading that week. And other things would happen that I was completely unaware of in the prison. Like, I had no idea, for example, how noisy it would be, why men had to get up at 4 a.m. sometimes to work in the kitchen. My impression of a prison was that men were sitting in their cells with lots and lots of time on their hands. What a great time to read classic literature. that was incredibly naive on my part. I mean, men had a very, very structured, men with a job had very structured lives. There were certain times when they have to stand in line for showers, they have to stand in line to use the phone, they have meals at a certain time, commissary period at a certain time. There's very little time actually to sit and relax and read. And even when they do, it's noisy, bright, and very, very difficult. So in the end, I realized that my expectations had been far too high, and I should be surprised when they did do the reading.
You said you had some other expectations that changed as you got into the book club.
I guess that eventually I realized that I was not necessarily going to turn these men into readers of literature, that what was interesting for them was the discussions that we had in the moment, in the room, about these books. They were not becoming readers. They were not necessarily going to read these books in their own time. They didn't necessarily enjoy the books. They didn't really see the point of them. And so in the end, I started to choose books that were more accessible to them. Like after Heart of Darkness and after Bartleby the Scrivener, which they both found very difficult, we read Bukowski's Ham on Rye, which was much more accessible and interesting to them.
Ham on Rye.
Right, which most of them loved. We read Junkie by William Burroughs. They wanted a prison novel, so we read On the Yard by Malcolm Braley. So I adapted my choices to meet their preferences.
Vincent, you were nodding when Makita Brotman said these guys were not going to become devotees of literature. I mean, I think you're one of the men who surprised her a bit, because your passion is not literature.
No, not at all. You know, my passion, you know, I really was in there as an administrative person to get there. But she did have a great teaching style and was able to explain these books, even though that we were having a difficult time in it. And then she came to understand that what we can get out of it is when we find situations where we can relate to a character, or we can relate to the situation that they may be going through. And so expand on those topics instead of talking about the great literary work that it was. And so I think we all kind of changed a little bit. But no, I'm certainly into policy change and prison reform, because I think it's very needed in order to reduce our recidivism rate. And I think that you have to do that. We have, you know, 2.5 million people in prison in America, and we need to do something about that.
Your bachelor's degree is in political science and sociology,
correct?
Right? But your master's is in humanities.
Humanities, yes.
And how does that play into the work you're trying to do, changing policy?
Well, I think, you know, we have to focus on, I mean, if this were the University of Maryland that had a 50% failure rate.
You're talking about the recent, how many
yes,
how many men in prison come back to prison.
Right, and they come back to
offend, you know, again.
And offend again within 3 years. And so between 40 and 50%. So if it were the University of Maryland, they would shut it down and change their curriculum. But the system just continues to go forward and forward. We've had some exciting changes this past legislative session, and I think that this is a good first step, but we have to do something about this. You just can't continue.
And you're out now talking about it. That is Vincent here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast, and also we're talking about the book Maximum Security Book Club, written by Makita Brotman, professor of humanities at MICA, who is here with us in the studio. We have a call from Chris in Ellicott City. Chris, welcome to Midday.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Sure. Your comment?
I guess I might be an outlier, having been educated before I became part of the system.
When you say part of the system, you spent time in prison?
Caught up in the political justice system with drug problems and things like that. I question kind of the idea of approaching Conrad as an initial subject, since it's got so many racial overtones that you don't even find in Apocalypse Now. I mean, being it's kind of film forebearer, but I feel like the ability to get books in the Maryland prison system is just very difficult. You have to have someone who's willing to send you directly from the publisher or directly from Amazon a book that you want. The library access is really something that is not even considered a privilege. It's more of considered something that you go there, you find maybe an occasional book that touches on your situation. I believe in the power of literature to transform. And I believe that more than I think most do. But I just don't think that the Maryland prison system provides the avenue with which inmates and even convicts, past convicts, are able to access material that can really help with their life.
And Chris, were you at Jessup or one of the other prisons?
I was in Towson Community, community prison for the maximum term, so double 18-month terms.
I appreciate your calling, Chris. Thank you. What's your reaction, Makita?
Yeah, about access to books, it's a real problem. I mean, it's only possible for men to get books themselves if they have someone on the outside who can send them books. Hardback books aren't allowed because they could be used as a weapon. The library's having continual problems. There's a constant turnover of librarians. It's very, very difficult to get someone permanent to work in the library. It's very difficult for people to access material. Of course, the prisoners aren't allowed to use the internet. I agree with your point about Conrad. A lot of people were very critical of me for choosing Heart of Darkness because it normally has been considered a racist book, but I see it as more as a psychological journey, an internal journey. And in fact, Conrad, Marlow, the narrator, begins by saying that this too has been one of the dark places of the earth. And he's actually talking about London back in primeval times. I think he's talking about the internal darkness in everyone rather than simply the darkness of the Congo. So I see it as a kind of psychological journey rather than a racial one.
Vincent, there were 10 books, right? In the correct. that you write about,
right.
I understand the book club continues, but there were 10 books,
yes,
you write about in Maximum Security Book Club. Which of those do you think you got the most out of, Vincent?
Well, I think the most it was a toss up between Macbeth or Metamorphosis.
Metamorphosis by Kafka.
By Kafka, right? So I like the Metamorphosis. I think that was a something that I could relate to.
This is the story about someone who becomes a cockroach. Yeah,
becomes a cockroach, right. And so, you know, dreaded by society. So, of course, I think it really related not only to me, but to a lot of other men and women that are in prison. They would draw the same analogy as to, you know, that's how sometimes, you know, you feel when you're inside a prison and humanity's being taken away and you're being deteriorated all the time for years after year after year. You try to hold on to some humanity and, you know, and doing this reading. And so that's what the cockroach did, try to hold on to his humanity whilst knowing that people thought he was a cockroach, knew he was a cockroach.
Carrick has called us from Gardensia. Carrick, welcome to Midday.
How you doing?
Doing great. How are you doing?
Pretty good. I just called a comment on a lady I was in the JCI. I was there for a couple of years. I was there from 2012, so probably about 6 months ago. And, you know, like you all was talking about, you know, like your humanity's taken away from you. And I remember numerous days and nights when I would read and it would just take me out of there. And for somebody like her to come in, you know, you do got good people in there, you know, that are very artistic. They got artistic skills, not just, you know, in art, but like in form of poetry and stuff like that. And for somebody to come in and let them people express themselves like that, just give them that much hope and that much little bit of freedom known that they ain't forgotten. You know, they still have a word to express themselves, you know, in different ways.
Carrick, I appreciate your calling us. Congratulations on being out. I hope it goes well. What do you think about Carrick's comment?
I think he's right. I mean, and one of the things that I remember Vincent saying when we were talking about Metamorphosis was that I remember him saying that it was a couple of years after he'd been in prison that he woke up, looked around the walls of his cell and realized, I'm not a human anymore. I'm a parasite. And it was a moment when I realized how it must feel to be abandoned by society like that. And I think that's really one of the things that's most important to the men, is that to realize that they're not forgotten, that then they haven't been abandoned. Even people who are not necessarily their relations or their friends think about them. And I began to think about these men in between sessions when I wasn't there. I began to worry about them. Of course, we weren't allowed to call them or write to them, but it made me realize how many people there are, both men and women in prison, who are absolutely neglected and lonely and forgotten, but really to made me want to show them that they're not forgotten. And reading is one way that they can escape from that situation, by identifying with different protagonists to give them a sense of their dignity, to human dignity, that they're not just lifers or criminals or convicts, that they're human beings with needs and desires and worthy of respect, despite what they may have done.
I was struck, yes, Vincent. Yeah,
and this is exactly why we cherish volunteers like Dr. Brotman and all the other volunteers that come in, because when they come in, you know, they see us for humans and they see us as people, and they reinvigorate your humanity, you know, just because you try to hold on to that. And so that's why it's you know, it's so necessary for people to you know, volunteer their time for prisons.
Well, one of the things that struck me that you wrote, Makeda Brotman, and I'm curious to get Vincent's view of it too. You at several points along the way, you mentioned that, for example, the men in the book club didn't necessarily know each other's names, even though they were living in the same prison, and even after they'd been in the book club a while. You mentioned a sort of a guard that men need to keep around themselves, not to get too close, and in fact, I'm going to now forget the name of which of your book club members it was whom you quote saying, correcting you when you said something about friends. He said, "I have no friends here.
That's right.
I have comrades." So, Vincent, you talk about holding on to humanity, but that seems like a very important part of humanity that you have to consciously put aside, or many men feel they do.
Right. I think, you know, what you talk about is that you do develop a group of people, whatever you want to call them. I have very close friends that are in prison and have for, you know, the 3 decades that I spent there. But talking about coming into a new group of people that you really don't know yet. And so therefore, as I said, you know, you have to get back and look at their value system and see where they're coming from. And so I think that once but once the group really gelled together, most of us became friends, you know. And so it's, but in the beginning, though, your guard has to be up.
But is Makeda right when she says that's not the common position you put yourself in living in prison?
Right. You don't leave yourself too vulnerable, of course, you know. I mean, It's a tough place. There's tough people there, but there's also good people there, and you know, you can get past that. Well, I certainly did. You know, I at least saw the good in people pretty easily, I think.
We need to take another quick break here. Lots more to talk about with Vincent and with Makeda Brotman, professor of humanities at MICA and author of The Maximum Security Book Club, Reading Literature in a Men's Prison. You can be part of this conversation. We'd love to have your comments about whether you think this makes a lot of sense, or what you would suggest as a good book for the Maximum Security Book Club to take up since it continues. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm talking about this hour with two people involved in the Maximum Security Book Club, Reading Literature in a Men's Prison. This is an account of the first 2 years of a book club at JCI, Jessup Correctional Institute. And here with me is the author of the book, Makita Brotman, a professor of humanities at MICA, and one of the men in the book club, Vincent, who is now out of prison. You can be part of this conversation. You can send us a comment or a question by email, midday@wypr.org. Or you can phone us at 410-662-8780. Which of the books of that first batch of books, Makita Brotman, did you think the men enjoyed most?
Definitely Ham on Rye, because it was the first of the books which was set in a setting that was recognizable. It's by Charles Bukowski. It's set in what's written in the 1970s, set in 1970s era Los Angeles. And if you're not familiar with Bukowski, he curses all the time. He drinks a lot, lots and lots of sex. He's a bitter, angry man, and a lot of the inmates could really identify with him, especially after all the Melville and the Conrad that we'd been reading. They were thrilled to have what they called a real book at last, and they found it very easy reading. They loved the vocabulary. They found it funny. It was the experiences of an alienated kid. And I think a lot of them could identify with Henry Chinaski, who's Bukowski's kind of alter ego character. And they found it, for the first time, that we were actually reading a book that was funny, they could get into it. It used profanities, and they realized that, for the first time, I think, that they could curse in front of me and let their guards down a little bit, and that literature doesn't have to be inaccessible.
Doesn't have to be
inaccessible.
Inaccessible, which is, I think, a big part of what you were hoping this whole experience would accomplish.
Right, right.
Vincent, you mentioned Macbeth as one of the ones that you liked,
right.
And Makita, you made the point in the book that it struck you, I gather, kind of in a flash that you had read Macbeth in lots of settings with lots of different people. You'd never read it with people who themselves, some of them, had committed murder. When you're reading the murder scene,
right.
What difference did that make?
Everyone was rapt when we were reading that scene. It had taken them a long time to get used to the language. We had a translation. We were reading a translation with the original on our opposite page. And everyone was nervous and anxious and quiet. Of course, the men were reading a part each, so that made it more of a community experience. And everyone was anxious about what was going to happen to Macbeth and the pressure that he was being put under by his wife. And I started to realize that they were really invested in this crime. And right at the end of the scene, after Macbeth has already started to regret what he's done, one of the guys looked up at me and said, "He's going to turn state's evidence."
That, as I recall, that was
Day-Day.
Day-Day. Tell us, and he, as you describe it, Day-Day was, he was a young, mm-hmm. a young man. I've forgotten what had put him in prison, but you were struck that he seemed to get the motivations of Macbeth, and I think several other characters,
right.
quite keenly.
More than I'd expected, and more than some of the other men. And I was very surprised at first, because he'd been a student in my psychology class, and I was a little intimidated by him, because he was a gang member. He was like very tightly wound. He had these dreadlocks. He used profanities when he spoke. And at first I wanted to say, "Vincent, why did you put Day-Day in my class?" But Vincent had his reasons.
And they were, Vincent?
Well, I believe that we have to give opportunities for people who have not seen it, you know, any other lifestyle that they had choices with when they were on the outside or even when they were inside prison. And I think that a lot of people, whether they're members of street organizations or whether they're just regular people need that opportunity to take the blinders off and understand that they have a lot to offer and, you know, have to figure out a way to get through these barriers of negative lifestyle, whether it's caught up in drugs or violence or whatever it is. And so, and I think that it's very successful. That was one of the reasons why we formed the college program and had other students and universities come in, is to let the younger guys know and let the younger people see that they have choices. And now that you have your, now you figure out that, yeah, well, you know, your blinders are off. Now you have choices. Before, you might not have saw a choice, but now you have the choice. And so
it's
we find it very, very effective.
It's an interesting perspective, because I think what I pick up from your description, Makita Brotman, is the absence of choice behind bars, the unrelenting boredom, the sort of grayness of the decor, the fact that there aren't bright colors, there aren't lovely things to look at. I would not have thought the experience says you've got choices.
Oh, you can live any lifestyle you want inside the prison. There's a prison inside a prison. So if you want to keep on living a negative lifestyle inside a prison, then there's a place that they call solitary confinement, which actually is very, very high in Maryland. Maryland had double the national average, 9.4% in solitary confinement. And a lot of these people were being released from solitary confinement. And, you know, the numbers of them coming back were
released
very high.
Released to the outside.
Released
finishing right to, their
finishing
their
sentence there.
That's a and huge so, transition.
Yes, and it's impossible. And, you know, again, we're double the national average. And that was addressed this year in the legislature also, and a reporting bill was passed. I think what this does, again, you have choices. You have choices every day. You can spend all day watching TV, can spend all day playing a little video game or whatever. You have choices how you want to spend your time. Your mind's free. How do you want to use your mind while you're in there? And so, your behavior, again, you can do positive things or negative things.
But I think you had an intuitive sense that Dede was smart and that he would respond to literature. And he had a way of thinking that other guys in his gang or that didn't, that he would, that he, you seem to know that he would respond to these things. You seem to know something about him that I didn't, because he really got into it. And he was one of the best members of the group.
Yeah.
How much turnover in the first 2 years was there? How, you started with 9 men?
Yeah, there was never any, I mean, nobody left except if they got transferred to another prison, if they got released, or if they died.
So it wasn't that men were saying, although there was someone you quoted, and I'm not going to remember now the name, but there was someone you quoted who said, this
yes.
isn't getting me any closer
That's
to release.
Right.
I'm
yeah.
all about getting closer
I
to
didn't,
release.
I didn't include his name, but he said, all that you do is great, but literature cannot get you out of prison, which is true. You know, reading can't set you free in that sense. I mean, metaphorically it can, but he was right, and I came to understand that the prison needs all kinds of things more than it needs a larger library or more books. It needs better medical facilities. It needs better showers. It needs better phones. It needs college credit courses for the men. It needs more education and training for the COs. I mean, there's all kinds of things.
COs are correctional officers.
Correct, yeah. So perhaps there's something a little bit naive of me to believe that, you know, literature can actually change people's lives, because I realize that in that literal sense, of course, it can't. People are suffering, and there's nothing, a book can't take them out of that physical pain. It can relieve the suffering for a while.
Well, I kind of have another viewpoint. My viewpoint would be, you know, it's about being educated. And so you're going to receive education many ways. That's why we have literature in our college courses. I mean, it's very important. And so when you become a reader and read and read and read, and 'cause I read for many, many, many years, you know, not only textbooks, but literature books and fiction. And I think it just, you know, it opens your eyes. It takes, you know, again, allows you to think outside the box. And that in itself, thinking outside the box, is thinking outside the prison system. And then that will probably help you to get out of prison.
You used a phrase a few minutes ago, Makita Brotman, something about, I didn't catch the whole thing, and I'm not trying to hold you to it as a goal, but I think you said that you saw the men sometimes identify with the protagonists. But you also write about almost the reverse of that, the extent to which sometimes, I think more often than not, you felt the men did not see themselves or see someone like them in a character where you could see a similarity.
That's right. Sometimes they did, and sometimes they didn't. So with the Bukowski, for example, many of them...
Again, Bukowski is which book?
The Ham on Rye.
Many
of them did identify with Bukowski's alter ego, where they all enjoyed that alienated character. But often I would give them books, for example, with Junkie by William Burroughs, for example, about a community of drug dealers and drug users, which many of the men were inside for that activity. And they were very unsympathetic towards the denizens of this underworld and certainly did not see themselves in it. The same with Bartleby the Scrivener. They were very unsympathetic towards Bartleby, did not see themselves in the character of Bartleby or the narrator of that novel. They really resisted identifying with characters who people outside the prison might identify them with. And perhaps that's not surprising. We don't really like to see ourselves as other seers.
But an interesting insight is to how people see themselves. We're almost out of time. Vincent, give me your shortest summary of what you think this book club meant for you.
I think this book club was very, very good for me as an individual and brought, you know, it was easy to see the humanity. When Makita would come in and all the other volunteers would come in, you were able to be in a situation where you felt normal, and you were in a classroom setting. Yes, there's a lot of oversight, but it's just so important that this type of book club here, and the college program, and other volunteers that come in for other organizations, continue to do it, because it's going to help save the soul.
Save the soul, Makita Brotman. The book club continues.
Yes.
Are you reading this summer? Or are you hiatus?
We're just taking a break for the moment.
What's the next book?
I'm not sure. We had a little turnaround where the men were choosing the books for a while. So they chose, we were doing Hemingway, Steinbeck, and Animal Farm. It was the last book that we read.
Wow. I wish you luck.
Thanks very much.
Thank you so much. Makita Brotman, Professor of Humanities at MICA and author of The Maximum Security Book Club, Reading Literature in a Men's Prison. Thank you.
Thanks.
And Vincent, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
I'm glad you're out. I hope things go well for you.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today for Midday Guests. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. Features signature burgers, wings, steaks, jumbo lump crab cakes. Open for lunch and dinner with breakfast on the weekends, on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow in the wake of mass shootings in places like Newtown, Connecticut, Aurora, Colorado, and now Orlando, Florida. Questions have followed about the shooter's mental health. We'll discuss the myths surrounding mental illness and violence, as well as the profile of recent mass shooters. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.